into from my Afghanistan days would recognize me as anything but the rather nondescript Lieutenant Buttigieg. For someone living the frenzied life of a visible elected official, the precincts of Joint Base Anacostia Bowling, better known as JBAB, might as well be a Swiss resort. I reported Monday morning to DIA headquarters at JBAB, collected an ID badge, and walked in past the Scud missile on display at the entrance and through the large daylit atrium toward the core of the enormous building. Looking for a cup of coffee, I walked a long hall, wearing my khaki uniform, as hundreds of civilians and other uniformed members came and went. I glanced down at the insignia on my chest, conscious that the wartime deployment had added to my military resume, more or less readable by scanning the color code of ribbons and insignia on an officer's breast. On my right was a wall with framed pictures of the officials comprising our chain of command, President Obama, of course, and Secretary Carter. There was the photo of the director, General Stewart. His predecessor, General Flynn, had been forced out the previous year, and a succession of other generals, colonels, and other assorted senior officers. All this was par for the course at a large military installation, but when I got to the area with the coffee shop, barber, and path to the cafeteria, I was greeted by an unexpected display. It was Pride Month, and a wall had been put up with colored stickers in a rainbow configuration. People were invited to write a message about how they supported their diverse DIA co-workers and stick it to the wall. Nearby, a poster advertised a speaker series on LGBT workplace issues. Years earlier, when I'd first come out to a close college friend, he had patted me on the shoulder and teased, "Well, you didn't make it easy on yourself." Between being an Indiana elected official and a military officer, it was hard to tell which side of my professional existence was going to be less LGBT friendly. But just a few years later, it was clear that the world was at least starting to change. After all, a bipartisan coalition had beaten back RFRA in Indiana, and the military had gone from firing any service member who tried to come out to actively welcoming its out members. There was even hope that the Supreme Court would extend marriage equality across the land later that year. Neither Indiana nor the uniformed services were going to be on the cutting edge of social change, but as I looked at this rainbow-colored exhibit in, of all places, the halls of the DIA, it now seemed being open about my sexual orientation might not be the career death sentence it had been less than 5 years earlier. I had concluded that the simplest way to disclose this to my community was in writing, so during downtime in Washington, I began taking notes for a short piece for the South Bend Tribune. I returned home and continued rewriting it, over and over again, asking some friends to look over the drafts, until I felt I had gotten down what I wanted to say most. Still believing that coming out should someday be a non-event, I titled it Why Coming Out Matters and Why It Shouldn't Have To, but the paper's editors shortened the headline to only the first half. I asserted that sexual orientation doesn't define someone and should be accepted simply as part of who we are. Being gay has had no bearing on my job performance in business, in the military, or in my current role as mayor, I wrote. It makes me no better or worse at handling a spreadsheet, a rifle, a committee meeting, or a hiring decision. I hope that residents will continue to judge me based on my effectiveness in serving our city, things like the condition of our neighborhoods, our economy, and our city services. The question I couldn't answer for sure was, would they? The article was to go live at 6 in the morning on June 16th, and for once, I slept poorly. At dawn, I was lifting barbells at the weight rack in my basement when text messages started lighting up my phone, coming in from friends not so much in order of how close we were as in order of how early they got up. I headed downtown as usual, where my first public event happened to be an outdoor pancake breakfast kicking off Bike to Work Week. South Bend's full complement of TV reporters appeared, asking all kinds of questions about why I had come out when I did. Was there someone I had met? Was something damaging about to be revealed by political opponents? Was I trying to make some kind of statement? So much for the pancakes. I knew these reporters well, and the aggressive questions threw me off at first. One looked hungry for a scoop as he pressed me. Another seemed half-hearted, almost embarrassed that his editors had instructed him to get this personal, while his cameraman looked at me with eyes that said, "Hey man, just doing my job." I told them that what I had to say was in the article, and returned to the importance of biking to work. A couple hours later, I was at a grand opening for a soup kitchen. More reporters, more questions, and not about the soup kitchen. I referred them to the article and repeatedly steered back to the issues of poverty and hunger that were impacting our city. Eventually, they got the idea. Around the community, people reacted in different ways. Inevitably, some of it was ugly. Local TV stations covered a press conference by a newly invented group calling itself the South Bend Leadership Coalition, led by a fringe right-wing activist who happened to live on my block. The mayor's announcement has created a crisis that goes to the heart of our political system, their statement said. They went on to insist that this was a matter of grave political importance, saying, "Is homosexuality now a consideration in hiring or in the granting of government contracts? Is support for the homosexual agenda now a requirement for employment or for the receiving of government contracts? Do homosexuals get favorable treatment when they apply for jobs or government contracts? Are other members of the Buttigieg administration homosexuals? If so, would they be willing to share this information with the public and explain whether this affects their ability to function as civil servants?" There was little point in responding. Either I was good at my job as mayor, or I was not. And if someone thought I was sitting around handpicking recipients of routine government contracts at all, let alone doing so based on sexual orientation, then it was unlikely that they understood our administration enough to judge it on its merits anyway. But things like this were the exception. The vast majority of the reaction fell into two categories: those who wanted me to know they were supportive, and those who wanted me to know they didn't care. Both sets of responses were welcome. The comments from people who were impacted were certainly touching. I had not done this out of any desire to make a statement or bring about a public result, but the hundreds, maybe thousands of emails coming into the city inbox made it clear that my coming out had made it easier for at least some others. One young man from conservative Marshall County wrote of his family, quote, "Their Christian beliefs tell them I'm living in sin and need rescued of my wayward lifestyle. But having men and women like you serving the public makes it much easier for families like mine to accept their own sons and daughters," end quote. People I had served with overseas got in touch. One who had volunteered with me on a risky convoy wrote to share that he was gay as well. Many to express support, and others just to say hello, to ask how I was doing, with no mention of the article at all. A couple weeks after coming out, I returned from a few days away for a conference and went to see my neighbor, Kathy, who had been picking up my newspapers and mail. She and Irv had retired from running a small business out of the home and had lived next door for decades. I assumed they were politically conservative, but we usually talked about neighborhood stuff, not politics. I asked her how things were going and saw tears welling in her eyes. "Did your mother tell you what happened?" "No," I said. "I hadn't checked in with her. What was the matter?" She noticed that I hadn't been getting my paper. No irregularity in our neighborhood gets past Kathy, and by the third day, she figured out that the paper carrier was skipping my house. So she confronted the delivery guy and asked him why I wasn't getting my Tribune. He said something about not wanting to give a newspaper to one of those. Wrong answer. "Has he done anything to you?" she demanded. "No," he admitted. I didn't catch all the details of how she proceeded to let him have it, but by the time I had gotten home, the paper was arriving faithfully every day. In my view, the biggest thing to turn the tide on LGBT issues wasn't theological or political evolution. It was the discovery that many people whom we already know turn out to be part of this category. The biggest obstacle wasn't religion or hatred. It was the simple fact that so many people believed, wrongly, that they didn't even know anyone who was gay. At my high school in the late 1990s, I didn't know of a single gay student. It is easier to be cruel or unfair to people in groups and in the abstract, harder to do so toward a specific person in your midst, especially if you know them already. Gays have the benefit of being a minority whose membership is not necessarily obvious when you meet one or love one. Common decency can kick in before there is time for prejudice to intervene. Of course, humans can be cruel to people we know, too, but not as often, and we're rarely as proud of it. In the struggle for equality, we do well to remember that all people want to be known as decent, respectful, and kind. If our first response toward anyone who struggles to get onto the right side of history is to denounce him as a bigot, we will force him into a defensive crouch, or into the arms of the extreme right. When a conservative socialite of a certain age would stop me on the street with a mischievous look, pat my arm, and say conspiratorially, "I met your friend the other day, and he is fabulous," it was not the time for a lecture on the distinction between a partner and a friend. She is on her way to acceptance, and she feels good about her way of getting there. It feels better to grow on your own terms than to be painted into a corner. Still, we had no real way of knowing in advance how coming out would affect the re-election that year. I had handily won the primary, the city was widely viewed as being on the right track, and my Republican opponent lacked a strong organization. But it was difficult to gauge whether voters would view me any differently now as summer gave way to fall and November approached. Nor was it clear how much my popularity had been impacted by the many tough decisions of my 4 years in office. I still believed, as I had commented to Mike Schmuel on election night back in 2011, that I could never be as popular as I was that night, because every difficult decision had to cost us at least a few votes. One source of concern was an ongoing controversy over the police department, known around South Bend as the Tapes case. It became an issue in early 2012, just a few months after I took office, when I relieved our police chief of his command in response to a federal investigation, though its roots went back to before I had even taken office. Police issues had not been a major theme of the campaign in 2011, but it was clear by the time I first took office that the department needed attention. Rumors swirled of favoritism, opportunism, and cliquishness within the police force. There was little evidence of a real promotion system or documented officer evaluations, which meant that career advancement hadn't fully outgrown the 60s-era norm in which your standing depended on popularity and political relationships. The place would need an overhaul sooner or later. But reforming the police department would be a major task, requiring new leadership, sustained attention, and political capital. In addition, while there were clearly management issues at the department, the current chief was well-liked in the community. As the first African-American chief in our city's history, he had been uniquely able to build confidence between communities of color and the department as a whole, and his track record of youth mentorship programs and other community work had paid dividends for the department's vital neighborhood relationships. So, after interviewing him and two competitors for the job, I decided during the transition phase that I would reappoint him and save major police department reforms for a future year. It turned out to be my first serious mistake as mayor. Somewhere during that transition phase, in the months before I took office, the internal politics of the department had boiled over. The chief, believing that some other officers were gunning for his job, allegedly confronted them with tape recordings that could embarrass them if disclosed. He had access to these tapes because some phone lines in the department were connected to recording equipment used for interviews and investigations, and the officers had been recorded on that equipment without their knowledge. As court filings would later document, the chief threatened to take action against at least one officer he had come to consider disloyal. Perhaps the chief didn't realize that I was already leaning toward reappointing him, or perhaps it just seemed like an insurance policy. Enter the Federal Wiretap Act, a set of very strict federal laws about recording other people without their knowledge. In fact, making such recordings or disclosing their content can be a felony, punishable by prison time as well as fines. There are state laws, too, against recording a conversation without the knowledge of either party, absent a warrant or other legal clearance. The recorded officers knew it and complained to federal authorities who took the issue seriously. So that's how it came to be that, a few weeks into the job of mayor, I learned that my newly reappointed police chief was being investigated by the FBI. Eventually, a message came through, thinly veiled but quite clear, from federal prosecutors. The people responsible for the covert recordings needed to go, or charges might be filed. Why did they send me that signal instead of just acting on their own? Was the intent to do me a favor, giving me a shot at resolving this quietly and helping my young administration without getting bogged down in the scandal of indictments just a few weeks after we got started? Maybe. Or perhaps they just understood the politics of all this before I did. Why should a U.S. attorney shoulder the responsibility of taking down a beloved African-American police chief if he can get the mayor to do it for him by removing him from his position? Justice would be served and compliance would be established, while charges and a messy trial could be avoided. In any case, whatever had led to this point, the choice now lay at my feet. I sat at the end of the conference table in my office and contemplated which scenario was more likely to tear the community apart. A well-liked African-American police chief potentially being indicted over compliance with a very technical federal law, or me removing him for allowing things to reach this point. There was no good option. The community would erupt either way. Maybe the chief would step down on his own, I thought. I called him. Another mistake. Things like this should be done in person. Since that day, I've never removed a direct report without sitting down with him or her for a face-to-face discussion, however painful and awkward. After I explained the situation and my view of it, he did offer his resignation, and I accepted it. The reaction was instant and fierce. Community activists demanded to know more details about what had happened, but I was worried that going into too much detail would get us sued. Eventually, I did go into more detail publicly, and a lawsuit quickly followed, teaching me another important lesson. By the next day, he had changed his mind and withdrew his resignation. Allies in the community, including many African-American leaders whose support and respect I had counted on before, had convinced him to change his mind, and now wanted me to change mine. But the status quo was not an option. Even leaving aside that I believe removing him was the best way to avoid him facing potential legal action, I had lost confidence in the leadership of a chief who had not come to me the moment he realized he was the target of an FBI investigation. The hiring and firing of officers in our city is ultimately up to a civilian board of public safety, but the mayor decides who ascends to senior rank. Acting on that authority, I demoted him from the position of chief to that of captain. Then something happened that I did not see coming. Local press began reporting on rumors that the tapes contained evidence of officers using racist language to describe the former chief. All of the five officers known to have been recorded were white. The content of the tapes had not come up when I was talking with staff or with the chief about the issue. If true, this was explosive and serious. The credibility and legitimacy of our police department depended heavily on the expectation that officers did their job with no racial animus. And since so many of the worst race-based abuses in modern American history happened at the hands of law enforcement, policing was the most sensitive part of the entire administration when it came to demonstrating that we acted without bias. Infuriatingly, I had no way of finding out if this was actually true. The entire crisis was the result of the fact that the recordings were allegedly made in violation of the law. Under the Federal Wiretap Act, this meant that it could be a felony not just to make the recordings, but to reproduce and disclose them. Like everyone else in the community, I wanted to know what was on these recordings. But it was potentially illegal for me to find out, and it was not clear I could even ask without fear of legal repercussions. As of this moment, I have not heard the recordings and still don't know if I and the public ever will. Overwhelming pressure mounted for me to disclose the recordings, especially from the African-American community. Protesters picketed my first State of the City address. A group calling itself Citizens United for Better Government formed and appeared in public meetings with custom-made T-shirts reading, "Release the Tapes." I invited a number of the most prominent community and faith leaders to meet in my living room so that I could explain the legal constraints I was under. They viewed my protestations skeptically, as did the Tribune, but legally I was stuck unless a court gave me room for maneuver. The story dominated media coverage of my administration for most of our first year, and affected my relationship with the African-American community in particular for years to come. A legal drama ensued, with the council suing the administration to release the tapes, while the officers sued the city over the fact that the tapes had been made in the first place. The technicalities became dizzying, with one branch of the city government suing another. Some parts of the case are still in litigation, years later, as we look to the courts to answer the basic question of whether I can lawfully authorize the recordings to be released. The most important lessons of this painful episode were not about the finer points of federal wiretapping laws, but about the deeply fraught relationship between law enforcement and communities of color. This issue, previously an abstraction for me, was now hitting home. Ferguson and everything that followed in the Black Lives Matter movement came after the tapes controversy exploded locally, but their urgency grew from the same root. The fact that many of the worst historical injustices visited upon black citizens of our country came at the hands of local law enforcement. Like an original sin, this basic fact burdens every police officer, no matter how good, and every neighborhood of color, no matter how safe, to this day. To the many people in the community who rose up to demand that the tapes be released, this wasn't a question of whether I was right or wrong in fearing that doing so would violate state and federal wiretap laws. It was about their belief that not everyone in the community could trust the men and women sworn to protect them. Like so many police officers and Americans of color dealing with the long reach of such past wrongs, and the present-day wrongs that flow from their legacy, I found myself answering not only for myself, but for history. Another challenge in the re-election campaign would be the mixed popularity of my approach to our streets downtown. While this entailed far less moral anguish than the police tape situation, it was in the headlines just as often, and led to even more critical letters to the editor and challenging conversations. Even many of my supporters weren't so sure of my approach, stopping me at the farmer's market or the sidelines of an event to say, "I love what you're doing with the city, except for your smart streets." Unlike our famous smart sewers, the program I had decided to call Smart Streets had little to do with sensor technology. It was about the hope of a better downtown, and the role of street design in making it happen. I had gotten a crash course in urban planning after becoming mayor, both literally, in the form of a seminar organized by the National Architecture Foundation and the Conference of Mayors, and figuratively, in meetings and meals with members of my administration trained in architecture and new urbanism. All of them seemed to agree that our city's downtown was nothing less than a tragedy of misguided urban renewal. Old photos corroborated the memories of people like Bob Urbanski showing people crisscrossing busy downtown streets full of shops, theaters, and hotels. But by the time I took office, downtown streets were about one thing: cars. The two main north-south roads in town had been converted, decades earlier, into a pair of four-lane, one-way streets that shunted traffic as quickly as possible through and out of downtown. The result was a quick commute through the heart of the city, but also a central business district that felt hostile to pedestrians. Going between my office and a restaurant a couple blocks away felt like walking alongside a highway, which is technically exactly what it was. The roads functioned to evacuate the very area I was trying to fill in. Other cities, from West Palm Beach to Louisville, had begun reversing this 60s-style road design, restoring two-way patterns to slow traffic a little and encourage more of a pedestrian and bike-friendly downtown. The idea seemed radical to many, since it often involved actually reducing the carrying capacity of roads. Growing up, I had only ever heard of roads being widened. Now, my planners were speaking of road diets, a concept that I knew immediately would be difficult to sell. The plan also required us to install roundabouts in order to properly distribute traffic through the redesigned road network. These were particularly controversial among residents who refused to believe that drivers could learn to use them, or that trucks and snowplows could fit through them, even though, obviously, we had checked. Still, to me, it was clearly the right way forward. And after over a year of refinement, dozens of public meetings, and a series of council votes to approve the vision and arrange the funding, it was set to become a reality. It also quickly became a campaign issue. Kelly Jones, my Republican opponent, made opposing it a central part of her campaign. One op-ed writer in the Tribune predicted that it would, quote, "kill any prospect of true revitalization and future growth above the ground floor," end quote. A Man on the Street interview for a TV station yielded this plainer assessment, quote, "I think the roundabouts are stupid," end quote. And in a debate, Jones sarcastically invoked my policy of public downtown Wi-Fi access as she predicted such long traffic jams that people would turn to in-drive entertainment. "I'm glad we'll have Wi-Fi," she said, "so those people stuck in traffic will have something to do." I was convinced that the community would eventually embrace the vision once they could see the results: an improved downtown and more business investment. Indeed, now that the project is complete, the result has been an estimated $90 million in new investment that has come to downtown from businesses saying the street projects were a major factor in their decision. Traffic, meanwhile, has only slowed by a minute or two in most cases. But during the 2015 re-election campaign, most of the improvements hadn't been completed, and people couldn't yet see the results. This, too, would cost some votes. But how many? Fortunately, even for a voter who disagreed with my decisions in the police matter and was skeptical of the plan for the roundabouts and two-way streets, there was no denying the city's accelerating transformation. Unemployment had been cut in half and had gone from well above the national average to within 1 point of the U.S. rate. Meanwhile, census estimates showed population levels increasing after a decade of contraction. Experience corroborated the numbers. The 25-story Chase Tower, the tallest building in our city, had gone vacant after a bankruptcy in receivership, its condition deteriorating so quickly that I had asked staff to estimate the cost of blowing it up. Now a buyer had emerged and was investing over $30 million to restore the building and open a new hotel there. Another problem property, the eerily empty former College Football Hall of Fame, also saw a buyer emerge and build a hotel on adjacent land, mentioning that our streetscape plan had helped motivate them to invest. A new owner had acquired the South Bend Cubs and invested millions to enhance our baseball stadium. Customers were dining on sushi in what had been a vacant former chicken wing restaurant downtown, while in one of our lowest-income neighborhoods, newly built co-op housing was emerging on formerly vacant lots in the wake of our 1,000 Houses in 1,000 Days effort. No less promising was the activity around the industrial area that formerly hosted decaying Studebaker buildings, largely thanks to industries that had not existed when cars were being manufactured there. On a grassy expanse, so serene that it was almost impossible to imagine the decade of work it had taken Mayor Lickey's administration just to remove the collapsing factories that once covered it, a sleek new building had now been built for a data hosting and analytics company first incubated on the campus of Notre Dame. It would soon receive a neighbor in the form of a high-tech laboratory for turbomachinery research, drawing top aerospace companies to the area. Meanwhile, another data center entrepreneur had purchased the 800,000-square-foot main assembly building of Studebaker, a six-story brick mass extending a fifth of a mile, long quiet but almost too stout even to demolish, and was proposing to create a mixed-use technology center in what had literally been the biggest physical symbol of our city's decline. Progress was palpable, especially after the city's 150th anniversary celebrations that spring of 2015. I could say with a straight face that our city was experiencing not just a comeback, but something akin to a miracle. Would voters agree? If applause at the debate and general sentiment among people I ran into were anything to go by, I was in good shape when the sun came up on November 3rd. I knew what it felt like to go into a losing battle and a winning one, and this felt like the latter. But what if I had misjudged my popularity? It seemed at least possible that voters might say one thing out loud but feel another when it came to my sexual orientation, my handling of a sensitive issue, or even my leave of absence for military duty. We would only truly know when the results came in. Huddled with a few key staff and loved ones in a small room off to the side of my office, home to the only working television set on the top floor, I fiddled with the antenna as the signal cut in and out, watching the local news. When the numbers finally did appear, they disproved what I had said to Mike that first election night. We won with 80% of the vote. It didn't only vindicate the work we had done over those 4 years. It showed that I would be judged based on that work alone. Our socially conservative community had either moved forward in its acceptance of minority sexual orientations or decided it didn't care. Either way, I had a mandate to continue our work and a deep sense of acceptance in the community. Of all the speeches I've given, the short one I offered in the Westside Democratic Club that night was perhaps the most heartfelt yet. 4 years ago, I said, I turned up as a political unknown, a rookie proposing a fresh start. And when I showed up asking for that fresh start, you gave me an opportunity to. You endorsed me as a leader, and you supported me as a friend. A year ago, when it came time for me to step away from the job and the home that I love, to go overseas and take up arms under the colors of our nation, you supported me as a brother. Earlier this year, when I was at the most vulnerable moment in my public and private life, you embraced me as a son. The city of South Bend means the world to me. I love South Bend. Analytical by nature, I surprised even myself with the emotional tenor of my words to the crowd that night. But I was moved by the support at the polls, which felt not only like a mandate for my administration's work, but also an affirmation of my relationship with the city that had produced me, welcomed me home, and accepted my sometimes novel way of doing business. A close observer might also have detected an additional influence on my tone and words that night. Most would see only the effusiveness you'd expect in a candidate relishing an overwhelming electoral margin. But those who knew me best would recognize something new in my countenance that night, the proverbial glow of a young man in love. Chapter 17. Becoming Whole. If you saw Chasten next to me at a restaurant or a party, with his tortoiseshell round glasses and gingham shirt with rolled-up sleeves tucked into a pair of jeans, you might assume he was in politics too, or a young lawyer perhaps. You might guess that he and I met at Harvard, or that he was finishing up his doctorate at Notre Dame. You wouldn't realize at first that you were seeing an avatar of middle America and of the challenges of millennial life. You wouldn't know that you were looking at a 4-H boy turned theater kid, a small-town product who found his way alone to Germany as an exchange student, or that he was the first in his family to complete college and move on to cannily survive alone in a big city, a graduate student with top grades whose teenage years had included a period of homelessness in Michigan. I hadn't seen any of that either. I just saw a nice-looking guy on an app and wanted to meet the man behind the big smile and blue eyes in the photo of him by the lakeshore, so I tapped the box on the right. Chasten was living at the time in Chicago, pushing through coursework for a master's in education at DePaul and paying his way by working as a substitute teacher in Chicago public schools, sometimes crashing on a friend's couch while letting out his apartment on Airbnb for extra income. I was a mayor, newly out of the closet and ready, at long last, to start dating, prepared that summer of 2015 to begin to experience the thrills and setbacks that most of my friends had gone through 15 years earlier. I had come out of the closet in order to make it possible, at last, to create a meaningful personal life. I was already well into my 30s, and hoping, as I've described, to have a family someday. The politics were what they were. Now that I didn't have to worry about being spotted or outed, it was time to start dating. But how? How is a gay mayor, or any mayor, supposed to go about getting a date? The closer to home I looked, the harder it seemed. It could be an ethical minefield. A mayor in his own city can certainly get his calls returned, but there's also the risk that someone will completely misunderstand why you're inviting them to meet for a coffee at Chicory Cafe or a pint at Fiddler's Hearth. Farther afield, friends from college were willing and eager to introduce me to people they knew, but most of the eligible guys in question lived in New York or Washington. To most of them, I was lost in the expanse of flyover country, probably even more remote than if I were overseas. Since I wasn't moving anytime soon, I was going to have to think closer to home. But when it came to South Bend, it wasn't even clear where to look. I thought of the countless local doctors and business leaders of my parents' generation who had seemed intent over the years on fixing me up with their bright and lovely daughters. Where were these would-be matchmakers now, and how was it that not one of them had a son or nephew that they wanted me to meet? My city had never felt so small. In the military, sometimes they talk about training age to describe the difference between longevity and experience. For example, if you were a 40-year-old major trained in field artillery and then switched to intelligence, you might have the same training age as a private first class 20 years your junior when it came to a specific skill like cryptography. That's how I felt about dating and romance. I was in my 30s, but my training age, so to speak, was practically zero. On my 33rd birthday, I was starting my fourth year as the mayor of a sizable city. I had served in a foreign war and dined with senators and governors. I had seen Red Square and the Great Pyramids of Giza, knew how to order a sandwich in seven languages, and was the owner of a large historic home on the St. Joseph River. But I had absolutely no idea what it was like to be in love. I'm far from the first person to find himself in that kind of strange and embarrassing position. Years in the closet have done that to millions of people. But my situation was still more unusual. In fact, it was unique. The scenario of a 30-something mayor, single, gay, interested in a long-term relationship, and looking for a date in Indiana, must have been a first. Luckily for this 21st-century problem, my generation had invented a ready solution. A proliferation of websites and apps promised to connect me to dateable guys within any radius I chose. I was young enough to try it, but also just old enough to consider it newfangled and a little risky. I wasn't immune to a previous generation's stigma when it comes to online dating. But I was living through the tipping point when it was becoming clear that many, perhaps most, new long-term relationships and even marriages had begun online. So I logged on. Now came another set of puzzles. What do you put down for occupation? What do you do if the best photos you have of yourself depict you in a suit with people standing around clapping? The pictures on my phone all looked great for politics, terrible for dating. Ribbon cuttings, groundbreakings, graduation speeches. Do you hide that you're a politician? Maybe, but you need to tell someone your name in order to date them. Then what? People have Google, and they're not stupid. Coming out as gay had been a hard thing to do in the political world. Coming out as a politician in the online dating world was even more perplexing. Confronted with the puzzle of how to describe my day job, I went for a middle ground. not to conceal that I was an elected official, but not to lead with it either. Friends helped me pick out the right photos for a profile, most of them doing something social and looking casual, but one giving a speech, an obligatory one from a beach, and of course one in uniform. Anyone who claims to be above using military service for dating purposes is lying. I looked mostly for people in Chicago, near enough to drive but far enough to be outside the viewing area of our TV stations, where most people had never heard of me. After setting up accounts one by one on websites and apps like OkCupid and Match.com, I started matching with people. A few chats led nowhere. Then I found some guys who actually seemed promising and started arranging dates. On that August weekend when some algorithm served Chasten and me up to each other, I had more time than usual to spend on my phone. I'd just been through surgery to address a hernia that had probably resulted from my deployment-inspired weightlifting regimen. So I was spending a lot of time on the couch, with an ice pack, binge-watching Game of Thrones and checking for updates, when Chasten and I started chatting through an app called Hinge. This app talks to your Facebook profile and is supposed to introduce you to people with mutual friends, though in our case it didn't reveal any common acquaintances, but just vaguely said, connected through your social network. It started with the usual small talk, something about weekend plans and watching TV, but it became clear to me that he had a quicker wit than most. Our first conversation is lost to the recesses of the deep web now, impossible for either of us to retrieve, but I remember being intrigued, then wanting to meet him in person. It helped that he neither dwelt on my position nor pretended not to notice it. A FaceTime conversation followed, his idea, another nice modern convenience that previous generations might have appreciated, to get a feel for whether you were about to go out with a jerk or an axe murderer. Each of us must have passed that test. We decided to meet up. Other than the same-sex aspect, our first date was something our parents could have recognized as typical, almost vintage. He rented a car to drive in from Chicago for what was supposed to be a coffee, but thanks to slow eastbound traffic, turned into a beer at Fiddler's Hearth, our downtown Irish pub. I talked about South Bend, he talked about his family, and his experiences in the classroom. In my pocket were two tickets to that night's baseball game, in case the date was going well, which it was. After some pub food, I proposed that we walk down to the ballpark to see our own South Bend Cubs take on the Great Lakes Loons. Somewhere around the sixth inning, we ditched the game to take a long walk along the river, through downtown, and over to the churning and multicolored river lights display that I had just inaugurated a few months earlier at the climax of the SB 150 celebrations. Crossing back toward downtown, along the railing of the Colfax Avenue Bridge, I felt the slight brushing of his hand coming closer to mine, and I took hold of it. Nothing in my life, from shaking hands with the president to experiencing my first rocket attack, matched the thrill of holding Chasten's hand for the first time. I was electrified. We got back to the car just as the post-game fireworks began, and as the explosions and lit colors unfolded over us, he went in for a kiss. We began to see each other every weekend, and it only took a few weeks for me to acknowledge the obvious. I was in love. Being a socially aware young person, Chasten follows and cares about politics, but his background was not political at all. His parents, who have a mom-and-pop landscaping business in Traverse City, have voted for candidates from both parties, but rarely discuss politics at home. Unlike mine, his political awareness came not as a dinner table inheritance, but as a response to how his world was shaped by the attitudes and decisions of those in power. As I saw in those first photos online, he has two tattoos. On the back of his right calf is a black infinity symbol, which he got to honor his mother, Sherry, after she was diagnosed with cancer. On his left tricep is a rectangular tattoo that resembles the flag of a country, red, green, and blue. It's one of the first things I noticed in that first picture of him that showed up on my phone, smiling brightly someplace overlooking Lake Michigan. Actually, it is not a flag, but the logo of Jif brand peanut butter, in honor of his father, Terry, who lived out of a car for much of his younger years and went on to build a stable middle-class life, home, and business. For Terry, Jif had once been a luxury. Having it on hand in the cupboard was the measure of a decent lifestyle. Terry would repeatedly promise to his three boys that no matter what, he would see to it that they would have Jif on the shelves. If one thing was immediately obvious about Chasten, it was his loyalty when it came to family. In addition to the tattoos, he wore a ring that, he explained, was one of a set of three he had purchased, one for each of the Glesman brothers. Sometimes supplementing his wages with food stamps, Chasten worked his way through community college in Michigan and later the University of Wisconsin at Eau Claire, where he earned a degree in theater education with a global studies minor. I joke with him about the number of jobs he's had. Once I asked him to recite them to me so I could write them down. Not counting helping around the family landscaping business, licking envelopes and making copies for his mom from the age of 12 or so, his first job was at a veterinary hospital, where he scrubbed kennels, cleaned surgery and exam rooms, and walked and fed the dogs. By 16, he added a second job, bussing tables in the aftermath of taco and burrito dinners at La Senorita, working until 11 some nights. Then he got a job at Cherry Republic, a touristy store in downtown Traverse City, offering cherry preserves, cherry cookbooks, aprons with cherries printed on them, cherry salsa, cherry horseradish. You get the idea. He stained wood as the shop was being built, then worked customer service there. As he contemplated a career in health, he got a job as a home health care aide, taking care of a boy with cerebral palsy, getting him off his school bus, feeding him, helping him stretch while watching The Ellen Show, bathing him, feeding him dinner. At 18, he enrolled in Northwestern Michigan College for nursing, and on top of his full-time course load, he worked a complimentary gig as a nursing assistant at Munson Medical Center in Traverse City. With a move to Milwaukee came another job, as a waiter at the short-lived CJ's restaurant. There was Christmas season work as a cashier at Toys R Us, and during the semester, a slot as a site coordinator for a tutoring service. In the summer, he taught theater classes for Upward Bound. He served drinks at a bar, worked retail at Eddie Bauer, poured coffee at Starbucks, and taught theater to children with autism at First Stage. Then, back in Chicago, found himself tending bar at a comedy club and recruiting for Performing Arts Academy. By the time I met him, he had realized that his future was in teaching, not nursing. He'd followed up his hard-earned bachelor's degree by enrolling in the Master's in Education program at DePaul, fitting coursework in between work hours and maintaining perfect grades. In the absence of substitute work during the summertime, he made ends meet and scratched the itch of his fondness for travel with a job guiding exchange students through O'Hare Airport, driving a herd of German or Korean teenagers from one terminal to another, while checking the phone in his downtime for Airbnb customers and people to date. The resourcefulness and work ethic, if not the restlessness, clearly came from his parents, Terry and Sherry. For them, income was never the guaranteed fruit of a lifelong career with one employer, but rather the yield of ingenuity, relationships, and hard work. As they raised their three boys in their one-story house just off Route 37, Terry was also constantly improving and rebuilding it with his own hands. Sherry works part-time helping other small businesses with their books, while Terry plows snow in the wintertime. Their landscaping business gets work throughout the year, but specializes in Christmas decorations. In a peak year, Terry and Sherry sell over 1,000 wreaths and 80,000 feet of garland after making it in the garage at their house or in their pole barn nearby. Speaking in front of any sized political crowd has never bothered me, but I was as nervous as a middle schooler on stage when we pulled up in the Glesman's driveway for the first time after a four-hour drive north to Grand Traverse County a few days before Christmas 2015. Earlier that day, I had been in full mayor mode, co-hosting an event with Governor Pence to celebrate a major economic development grant. Now, sitting in my sweater and jeans in the passenger seat of the Jeep, with a sleigh's worth of presents in the back for Chasten's uncountable slew of extended family relatives, I had become a living cliché from a holiday season romantic comedy, the boyfriend coming home to meet the parents for the first time. I don't know who was more anxious, him or me, but at least Chasten had the advantage of being at home. The front yard was a Christmas wonderland, complete with lights and Santa figures. When the boys were young, Terry was known to go out while they were sleeping and use deer hooves to create reindeer prints in the snow on the roof. Chasten beeped a horn as we came to a stop in the driveway, and within seconds a yellow lab came bounding out of the garage door, followed by an equally energetic Sherry and Terry. "Hey, Bubby," Sherry enthused, looking younger than her pictures as she emerged from the garage to greet Chasten with a big hug. Next, it was my turn, and the hug was just as big, followed by a generous handshake from Terry before he instinctively began helping carry in our things. It quickly became obvious that I had nothing to be nervous about. Almost immediately, I was on a sofa in their carpeted living room, answering questions about home and hearing about what Chasten was like as a kid. Since we hadn't been dating that long, It had been decided that I would sleep in the guest room, which had previously been Chasten's own. He, meanwhile, was relegated to the couch in the basement. By the next day, to Chasten's chagrin, we were reviewing embarrassing home videos of his boyhood. Sitting cross-legged on the carpet in sweatpants, as the smell of homemade cinnamon buns wafted out of the kitchen, watching VHS footage of my goofy boyfriend-to-be at age 14 in a school skit, while also playing one-handed tug-of-war with the dog, I felt more at home than I would have thought possible. The walls of the cozy living room ricocheted with the sound of Sherry's high, contagious laugh as she threw back her head of long, jet-black hair to relish one joke after the other. Terry was quieter, sitting in a recliner and smiling more with his eyes than his mustachioed mouth, occasionally patting beads of sweat off his shaved head with a bandana and contributing details to the family stories being swapped. We'd been dating only a few months, from that August night at the ballpark to this Northern Michigan holiday, but I felt immediately welcomed into the family. I got just as far as discovering the shoebox with the potty training videos before Chasten felt compelled to intervene in my bonding with his parents and proposed we go to the kitchen table and play cards or something. Later, when we arrived at the pole barn for the extended family Christmas dinner, too big to fit in a house, a giant stocking with my name on it took its place on the inside of the garage door alongside those for the 24 aunts, uncles, and cousins, filled with peanut butter cups and Slim Jims. So warm is the blanket of love in that household, wrapped around Chasten and me both, that I struggled to visualize the darkness of a time in which he did not feel welcome there. Chasten, braver than I, came out at the age of 17. Hungering to understand the world, he had enrolled in a student exchange program, against his parents' wishes, and gone to Germany. In that year abroad, he gained a command of spoken German, a little weight on his scrawny teenage frame, and a deeper awareness of who he was. Incapable of self-deception, he fully understood by the time he came back that he was gay, and needed for his family to know. They thought it was a choice. It made no sense to them, hard-working and church-going people who did everything they knew how to set a strong foundation in life for their three boys, that the youngest could select such a destructive and immoral path. How could he harm his family like this? Or was it somehow their own fault, something they had done wrong when he was little, or even before he had been born? In the weeks of turmoil that followed, it became Chasten's turn to sleep in a car, as his father had. Working two jobs, enrolling at community college, and rotating between nights on friends' couches and in a discreetly parked 2004 Saturn Ion, he was too busy and disoriented to contemplate the word homeless or apply it to his own case. He worked, he studied, he slept, while back home some kind of battle played out between things believed, things felt, things assumed, and things discovered. That battle took place out of view, but it ended when love and acceptance asserted their victory in the form of an unexpected phone call asking him to come back home. Those painful days seemed impossibly distant by the time I met the family that warm Christmas, and only more so across the visits that followed, and led naturally to a Thanksgiving morning that saw me rise before dawn at Chasten's side in the guest room and tiptoe out to head for the deer blind with Terry. A kind of adoption was in progress, communicated that morning in a different way than Sherry's big hugs and loud laugh, but just as clear in the coffee and jerky proffered on the way out, the companionable silence as we shivered and scanned the woods for hours, and the wide-ranging chatter as we made our way back. I was made to feel the unique sense of welcome that comes from someone whose love for a son means love for whomever he loves, given on the sole condition that he be trustworthy. After dinner, Terry and some of the boys went out for a second round of hunting, but in the traditional post-turkey drowsiness, I decided to stay talking in the living room with the others, as the conversation turned to Sherry's battle with skin cancer. She described her new treatment with a topical chemotherapy that came in the form of a potent cream that she applied, wearing gloves, to burn off the cancerous areas. Then she produced a package of the stuff from the bathroom so I could see how mundane this life-saving medication looked. I blinked in disbelief as she held up what resembled a tube of toothpaste and explained that each one cost over $2,000. Or that's what it would cost if not for the insurance she had purchased through the health insurance exchanges that had been set up as part of Obamacare. I thought and spoke of that moment often later as I talked about why health policy was not a theoretical question for our family. And it was, each passing holiday, more and more our family, a different one than the one I'd grown up with, but surprisingly compatible, too. One summer weekend, my parents came up to Traverse and we went out on the Glesman's pontoon boat together, nibbling on Terry's smoked fish and motoring among different favorite swimming and fishing spots. If the stereotypes of our divided society in 2016 were to be believed, there would be little hope of my liberal, intellectual parents relating to Chasten's gun-collecting, working-class, small-business-owning, rural Michigan mother and father. But 5 minutes on the boat made it clear they would get on famously. Their rapport got a boost from the universal language of fishing, both social and introspective, which is capable of uniting people of almost any style and background. But mostly, it was because of the simple, transitive effect of love. My parents for me, his for him, and therefore all of theirs for us and for each other, all rooted in the strong desire for us to be happy. Chasten's parents are the kind of people who sometimes pay for the customer behind them at the drive-thru window at McDonald's, just to put a little good out into the world. So it isn't surprising that I'm showered with gifts whenever I'm at their home. Anything I have admitted to enjoying will make an appearance, from Reese's peanut butter cups left under my pillow at night, to offerings of dark roast Keurig pods that Cherry will save in between my visits, knowing I'll enjoy them more than anyone else in the household. But I really knew I was a member of the family when I became the object of their truest expression of fondness, teasing. As we filled up at a Shell station one Labor Day weekend amid an extended family camping trip in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, I volunteered to run inside and fetch breakfast supplies for the next morning at the campsite. "Could you pick up some blinker fluid while you're in there?" "Sure," I agreed, not processing the question too actively and somehow not detecting the conspiratorial telepathy among Chasten, Terry, and Sherry. "For this car, you got to make sure it's the E50, Terry added, "the purple kind." Chasten nodded in solemn agreement. I committed the specs to memory. E50, purple, got it. Inside, I found bacon and eggs in the refrigerated section, then made my way to the car supplies. Not finding anything purple or marked E50, I worked back along the aisle a second time, without success, and then started to look for the clerk. Just as I began asking for help, I heard the chime at the door as Sherry came inside. As the other two chuckled in the car, she couldn't resist making sure she was on hand to witness the interaction. That way, later, around the campfire, she could describe the look on my face at precisely the moment it dawned on me, while repeating myself to a quizzical store clerk, that there is no such thing as blinker fluid. Back home, as Chasten and I had become a couple, it was not readily clear to either of us how we were supposed to act in public. But we quickly formed the habit of conducting ourselves like any other couple, and found that we were generally treated that way. The harder part for him was the challenge that awaits any political plus one, dealing with the volume of positive and negative attention coming to you and to someone you love as a consequence of a life that he, not you, has chosen. One day, not long after we had begun to live together, Chasten was making an evening grocery run to Martin's. In the refrigerated section, he pulled open a glass door to select a carton of yogurt. Eyeing his choices, he suddenly heard a tapping sound next to his ear. Startled, he turned to the right and found someone knocking on the glass. Abandoning his yogurt selection for a moment, Chasten closed the door between them and asked how he could be helpful. The constituent's request was simple enough. "You tell your husband to stop fucking up the streets downtown." Evidently, the gentleman was not a fan of our Smart Streets initiative. It was beside the point that he may not have fully appreciated the economic benefits of a complete streets policy, or that he was unaware Chasten and I were not yet married. In that moment, Chasten realized that he, too, had become a public figure, and would have to answer for me as well as himself. Even as he lives his own demanding professional life as a classroom teacher and head of junior high at the same Montessori school I attended as a child, Chasten has found that he constantly has to represent not just me, but also a city administration in which he has no formal role. As we flop down in the living room after a long day of work, most of his stories are about the school day, but some are inevitably about how my work has invaded his. A day won't go by without some kind of intrusion. It can occasionally be endearing, but just as often it will be frustrating, such as the staff meeting where an idea he mentioned was met with the response, "Is that your idea or the mayor's?" Or it's just peculiar, as when a stranger lobbies him to get the city to stop putting fluoride in our drinking water. Perhaps it is the fear of any queer person preparing to come out that he or she will be marked as a kind of other, isolated from the straight world by virtue of being different. No doubt many have had that kind of experience, indeed all do at least a little bit. But the main consequence for me of coming out, and especially of finding Chasten, is that I have felt more common ground than ever before with the personal lives of other, mostly straight, people. Before, I could rarely relate to the stories I heard from others when it came to adult domestic life or romance. Today, being in a committed relationship with Chasten just might be the most normal thing about my life. I no longer have to extrapolate or use imagination to understand what colleagues are describing when it comes to their wives or husbands. Our world at home is full of the blessings of domestic life, and the frustrations, too, from my irritation that it's hard to get him to fold the laundry as I do, to his bemusement at my stubborn indifference to expiration dates on items in the cupboard. For this reason, most of all, it is mystifying that some persist in describing sexual orientation as a lifestyle. In those fragments of our days that aren't dominated by work, our lifestyle revolves around meals, friends, exercise, housekeeping, sleep, extended family, and the care and feeding of our dog. Trying to visualize it from the outside, it strikes me that my partnered gay lifestyle is a lot more normal, sustainable, and fulfilling than my prior lifestyle, consisting almost entirely of work and travel. In that context, something as simple as taking care of a dog would have been inconceivable. Truman, our rescue mutt, was named Lamar when we went to visit him at the foster family that had been keeping him for weeks after a couple failed adoption attempts. A hound and beagle mix, said to be about 4 years old, he had come from Kentucky by way of an animal rescue that specializes in getting dogs out of shelters in high-kill states. He had clearly been badly mistreated and was at first extremely skittish. As his foster owner in Granger led him out on a leash to meet us in her yard, he avoided eye contact with either of us. As soon as Chasten went to pet him, he pancaked onto the ground in a passive slouch. Maybe the earlier adoptions hadn't worked out because he just didn't act very dog-like. But Chasten was convinced there wasn't anything wrong with him that a few months of love couldn't fix. Trying to think ahead, I was more reluctant. Once, weeks earlier, he had wondered aloud whether we were in a position to responsibly take care of a dog, and I had pointed out that we didn't even seem to be in a position to responsibly take care of cheese. After all, things constantly went bad in our fridge as we went days at a time without a meal at home. Taking good care of a pet would mean a change in, well, lifestyle. But the dog was irresistible, and Chasten reminded me that we had a good support network despite our work and travel schedules, especially since my parents lived around the corner. The next thing I knew, we were the loving owners of a 4-ish-year-old hound whom we rechristened Truman, after the president who had quipped, "If you want a friend in Washington, get a dog." Early in my relationship with our new family member, I often thought of this saying with irony. For the first few weeks, he would get up and go to a different room if I so much as made eye contact. After that habit subsided, he still tended to run away and hide under a table any time I tried to leash him. He wasn't exactly man's best friend. But over the months, he bonded with Chasten and eventually with me, becoming the class pet in Chasten's schoolroom and curling up in our bed with us at home. Now I return home to a serenade of barks and howls, a wagging tail, and all of the goofy excitement that you'd expect from a four-legged canine companion. Chasten's life, and mine, had become so fully intertwined that I was completely unprepared for the jolt of a winter afternoon text, which led to 7 minutes in which I doubted I'd see him again. He was abroad, getting an early start on a winter vacation in which I was to catch up to him a couple days later. I was working when the unreal-seeming text message lit up my phone. "Problem on plane, dash, lots of commotion, dash, don't know what's going on. Captain said making landing for, quote, secret reason, end quote. Love you, love you, love you." I texted, paced, and waited for 7 inordinately long minutes until another text came. He had landed, he wasn't sure where. It turned out to be Bucharest. There had been a bomb scare on board. He was fine, but shaken. Passengers had been crying, shouting, and a few were running in the aisles even as it landed. When I finally caught up to him in Berlin, he asked me to walk with him to the Brandenburg Gate. Lit splendidly in the cold night, it was one of those landmarks that looks exactly the way it is supposed to. It was also, Chasten explained, a place he came to while he was figuring himself out as a teenage exchange student, watching the people come and go, and fitting himself into a bigger world. He described the terror as the plane made its steep and sudden descent. "All I could think about was how unfair it was that I would lose the chance to have a life with you," he told me, and reached into his bag. I'm not going to get on one knee, but... Now I was afraid again for a different reason. I really did love him, and no other attraction or relationship had compared to the feeling of wholeness I had with Chasten. But it had been less than 2 years, and I still felt new at this. Our first date wasn't just our first date. It came at the beginning